Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight's show is about how schools in the Bay Area can help reduce teen suicide. Many Bay Area communities have witnessed several teen suicides and suicide clusters in recent years, some of which have been highly publicized, such as those in Palo Alto. However, these deaths are not isolated to the Bay Area, and adolescent suicide is a national issue. Suicide is the most common cause of death in adolescent and young adults in the United States, and in fact, suicide results in more deaths in this age group than all natural causes combined. And while factors leading to suicide are complex, up to 90% of deaths occur in individuals who have a history of significant mental health issues lasting longer than a year. The cost to society is high. A significant number of attempted suicides result in medical attention, and the price of a lost life is difficult to ascertain. However, the emotional toll on family, friends, and the community cannot be quantified. While only one component in suicide prevention, tonight we investigate what some Bay Area schools are doing to reduce stress, anxiety, and depression in our teens. Tonight, we will look at how the current state of the U.S. educational system and our definition of success is contributing to escalating anxiety in our youth. We ask what programs have been adopted to identify those at risk and how to prevent suicide. And how are teens getting involved? And finally, what else can be done at the local and national level? Joining me here in the studio to discuss these issues and more are Dr. Shashank Joshi. He is director of the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Residency Program and School Mental Health Services at Stanford and Lucile Packard Children's Hospital. Dr. Joshi has also helped develop Project Safety Net Palo Alto and is a member of the Executive Committee of the HEARD Alliance, two organizations focused on improving the mental health of our youth. He is the author of numerous publications, including School-Based Suicide Prevention, Content, Process, and the Role of Trusted Adults and Peers. Welcome, Dr. Joshi.
Thank you.
We're also joined here in the studio by Dr. Denise Herman. She is principal at Gunn High School in Palo Alto. Welcome, Dr. Herman.
Thank you.
And finally in the studio, we are joined by Vicki Abeles. She's an education reformer and director and producer of two documentaries about the academic pressures facing youth, the critically acclaimed Race to Nowhere, and her new film, Beyond Measure, from which a book by the same name will be published shortly. Welcome, Ms. Abeles.
Thank you.
And we're joined by phone by two guests, Christy Blackburn, who for the past 12 years has advised The Oracle, Gunn High School's student newspaper. She's also been consistently involved in larger mental health projects at the school. Welcome, Christy.
Thank you.
And finally, by Shauna Chen. She's currently a senior at Gunn High School. She's the editor-in-chief of The Oracle and the creator of the Changing Narrative series, a column publishing personal narratives focused on normalizing struggles and destigmatizing mental health issues among students. Welcome, Shauna.
Thank you.
And as you know, we'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes to bring you, the listener, into our conversation tonight. And you can dial 415-841-4134 to join our conversation. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You could also email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment at the KALW website. Before we get started, I wanted to give out an important phone number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, a network of 164 crisis centers in 49 states across the U.S., available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, by phone, to talk with you when you feel that you may be in a crisis. That number is 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. We'll include that link and additional resources at our website after the program. So now, Dr. Joshi, may I call you Shashank?
Sure, please.
I'd like to start with you. Just give us a little bit more of the background of teen suicide in the United States. Tell us a little bit about the demographics and how those demographics may be shifting.
Sure. Well, thanks. It's good to be here. Before I begin, I want to just thank you for bringing us all together. I think one of the things that's really important is to focus on learning some lessons from communities that have had loss. And unfortunately, teen suicide is not going down. If anything, depending on what geographic locale you're talking about, we do see numbers going up in certain areas. There are about 4,600 or so teen deaths per year. And we say teen deaths, we're usually talking about the CDC numbers, and they will often group them from the 15 to 24 age group or the 10 to 24 age group. So for purposes of this, I'll say in the 10 to 24 age group, we're losing about 12 young people a day. And that pales in the number of attempts. We have almost 600,000 attempts per year, 4,600 completions. So what that tells us is, while in our locale we may not see people taking their lives regularly, in most communities around the U.S., teens with particularly those with mental health problems have thought about ways to make their conditions better or ways to make their conditions go away. And that includes taking one's own life. And some of those risk factors go up in particular for teens who live in environments where, most importantly, there may have been suicide in their high school or in their city. Now with social media, if they hear about a suicide, they can quickly look it up, and it travels very, very quickly. And then unfortunately what happens is around the world we've seen trends in the way the media might portray these deaths and in some ways might unwittingly glorify what happened. So part of the opportunity here for us is to be able to talk more about what kinds of things that communities can do, specifically what youth can do, what schools, what parents and community members can do around upstream interventions, talking about some of the stressors that may lead someone to go from normal everyday stress to what's called distress to what's called desperation. And again, I want to highlight the idea that people who are stressed don't generally think about taking their lives. Stress is very common. Half of all U.S. adults will say stress impacts their life in some way. And yet we know only a small percentage of those will actually make a serious suicide attempt. When it comes to teenagers, we know that there are certain demographic profiles that may give you the highest risk.
What are those?
Well, we know, for example, that Native American youth are at very high risk for attempting and completing suicide. We know that Caucasian youth account for about 13% of all suicide deaths. Latinos are about 9%. Asian Americans are about 7%. African Americans are a little less than that. And then you throw in some of the other factors that may allow someone to reach out for help or accept help. When you talk about stigma, for example, around help seeking, some of the research we've done and some colleagues have done looking specifically at cultural factors have been very illuminating regarding how we understand that stigma doesn't discriminate, but there's some communities that may have more help available in a culturally effective way than other communities. And many of the local counties here, Santa Clara, San Mateo, and San Francisco specifically, have been trying very hard to promote education campaigns that are aimed not only at majority culture communities but also minority culture communities in ways that can destigmatize the idea of getting help at the signs of stress or severe stress.
So you mentioned that these rates are increasing. Can you give us a benchmark of, another time period mm-hmm. when this wasn't as prevalent?
Well, I can tell you that in terms of recent increases, the CDC does a survey every couple of years, and the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. And usually they get 48 states. Sometimes they get all 50 states to participate. But it's a pretty good sense of how our youth are doing. And we do know that in terms of the overall rates of depression and anxiety, those have been increasing slightly over the last 10 to 15 years. For me, a more alarming statistic is that about 15 to 17% of American teenagers think about taking their life in a year's period of time. And that number stayed about the same. But the number that's been growing have been the number of American youth who actually make a serious suicide attempt. And that number's been going up from about 1.8 to 2% at the time of the survey in 2011 to now around 2.5% in the most recent CDC survey. So those are kids who've made attempts that are serious enough to land in an emergency room and have an interface with a doctor. And so in a community of 2,000 students at a big, say, Bay Area high school, if you just crunch the numbers and say 2% of those kids might have made a serious attempt, then you've got about 40 kids who will have, on average, will have made an attempt serious enough.
So am I getting it right? You're saying that the increase in suicide attempts is outstripping the actual increase in depression and anxiety?
I'm not sure if I would make the direct increase in terms of, because the numbers are a little bit different there in terms of when you're looking overall population numbers, and a lot of that will depend on your locale. It may also be that as a society we're getting a little better at detecting, say, depression and anxiety rates. So that may have had something to do with a little bit of the increase. But what we're seeing in terms of serious suicide attempts has been, I think, alarming for those of us working in the field, that nationally we're seeing that these attempts are increasing over the last 4 to 5 years.
So I want to turn to you next, Vicki Abeles, to give us a bigger picture on the national front. You've done a lot of reporting on this, both in written and in film form. Tell us about what you understand to be the societal underpinnings for what Shashank is describing.
So I think big picture, we're living at a time in a really unhealthy culture, and that culture has infiltrated our schools. We have an education culture that is driven by competition, that is driven by busyness, overscheduling, too much homework, too much measurement. And I think that that is impacting our kids' health and well-being.
And so give us some examples of that. What does that look like?
Well, a recent study we did at a local high school, for example, in conjunction with St. Louis Medical School and a pediatrician and educator there, we surveyed a student body of roughly 2,000 students, and more than 80% of those students reported clinical anxiety. More than half of the students showed up with clinical depression, and I think those numbers should alarm us. I started out in this work about 8 years ago with a film called Race to Nowhere that really looked at the way our very narrow view of success in our culture and our schools is impacting our kids' health and well-being. We have kids who are sleep-deprived. Only about 6% of American teens get enough sleep each night, and that absolutely plays a role in their mental health.
How much sleep should they be getting?
They should be getting roughly 8 to 9 hours a night, and very few students are getting enough sleep. And I think one of the places that we need to look as parents, as educators, as school communities is we need to look at the way that time is used inside and outside of school. I think the reality is our students spend about 35 hours a week in school, and then outside of school, if they have one school-sponsored activity, that activity might take 10 to 15 hours a week, and on top of that, another 10 to 20 hours of homework. Pretty soon, you see you have teenagers who are putting in 70-hour weeks, and that's not sustainable. I think that's playing a huge role in their well-being today. And I think we have a public health crisis, and I'm so glad to be here tonight with an educator, with a school leader, with a physician, because I think we have an opportunity right now. We're at a moment where there's been a lot of attention on these issues, and I think we have an opportunity to create some change that not only improves students' health, but actually better prepares them to thrive in the future.
So how did we get here? How did we get to this pressure cooker, if you would call it that, way of treating our kids? What happened?
Right. I think it's complex, and there's not one particular thing you can point to. There's a lot of fear right now, and has been for the last decade or so, about what the future holds for our kids. You have policies that have influenced what's happening in our schools, No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top. You've got an admissions frenzy for colleges and universities. I think there are a lot of things that have come together and created the perfect storm. Mm-hmm. But I'm also incredibly optimistic because, again, I think this conversation is happening in schools across the country. And we're talking about a cultural shift, and that cultural shift starts with shifting people's minds around what makes for a healthy and successful childhood and how best to develop young people to flourish both today and in the future.
So Denise Herman from the from Gunn High School and the Palo Alto Unified School District, tell us about what what your experience has been on the ground, literally, of what you're hearing from our guests so far. Do you see this in your school and your school district?
I do see students who continue to try and find balance in their life. We have students who are very driven to be successful, and one of the things that they're trying to find is a way to be academically successful, sports-wise successful, to volunteer and be the best person they can be. And right now, it is difficult for them to manage that. At Gunn, we are trying to introduce new tools for students to support them in really carefully thinking through. For example, right now students are selecting courses for the school year next year, and we're having them use a time management sheet that says, what are the 6 or 7 courses I'm going to take? How much homework will there be each evening? What kind of outside co-curriculars am I going to have? Do I have a job? Am I doing an internship? What are my family commitments? Because that's what parents report to us is one of the things that typically suffers is time that students have to spend with their families. And then how much sleep do I need? And how much time can I take for my own personal growth as a student? So the school counselors are working with students as they make their course choices to say, is this all going to fit? And if you are potentially overscheduling yourself, what's going to give? And to have that conversation ahead of time and to make sure that parents and students understand what this would look like in a reality as the student's life plays out in any given year of their curriculum. The other thing that we're doing is trying to focus on, last year we had a lot of work to do with postvention, making sure that our whole school community felt supported following the crises. But we also really did some work on saying what kind of intervention do our students need who might be in the real time experiencing crisis in terms of depression or anxiety or other stressors in their life. And one thing that's more important in terms of the bigger picture is really focusing on prevention and making sure that our school community is doing things to reduce stigma, is doing things to reduce some of the daily stressors that students experience in high school, that they're sort of just-in-time outlets for students, either their peers. We've done a lot to educate peers. You'll hear from one of our teachers who's going to be talking in a little bit about sources of strength and not in our schools week and some other initiatives that really are a cornerstone of the Gunn community and ways that we're trying to make sure students feel comfortable talking with one another about how they might be feeling. If it's stressed, I'm feeling concerned about a test, I'm feeling concerned about a breakup, that they know that it's okay to let those things out, either with a peer or with a trusted adult, and to not let those things, you know, start to pile up and create undue stress that could exhibit itself in some unhealthy ways.
And I just want to say, I think one of the things that we've had the pleasure to do in working with Gunn High School and Palo Alto High School and other schools is a lot of this comes from the top. And you see when Sources of Strength, which is a program that Denise highlighted, which is one of the evidence-supported prevention programs that we've been involved with from a research perspective, not only there but at several other Bay Area schools, you see the role not only of trusted adults, as Denise talked about, but also of peer leaders, of diverse groups of students nominated by the faculty, different cliques, different opinion leaders among students who are carrying these messages of positivity, positive messaging. You're going to hear from Shauna later, the editor of the Oracle, about the way the kids are really writing the narrative and normalizing that stress happens in everyday life. And how do you deal with, you know, what are your sources of strength, so to speak, to help you get through these everyday stressors? So we're striving for balance as young people and not waiting until we're in college or after college mm-hmm. to figure out how to balance the sort of schedules we have. There are organizations now such as Challenge Success. If you go to their website, you can actually see some of these calendars or schedules where you can work in playtime, downtime, family time, mm-hmm. as Denise Clark Pope mm-hmm. likes to talk about. There's a wonderful article in New York Times, in, I think it's January 4th or 5th, that is highlighting from her book, Overstressed and Underprepared, how these elements need to be fostered from not only elementary school, but also in high school, the concepts of playtime, downtime, and family time.
Well, and Vicki mentioned how important she thinks time is to being a contributor to potential stress, but also being a part of the solution. And at Gunn High School, we did institute a new modified block schedule this year that increases the amount of downtime students have between classes. We have a longer lunch. Students meet only 3 times a week, and they have less different classes of homework to try and manage. So our initial data we received from the student feedback in December was very positive that the schedule that we've gone to that slows down the pace of the day really is helping them feel like they are much more in control of their own learning.
Vicki, you wanted to add something there?
Yeah, no, I was just going to add that I think we need to remember our students spend the bulk of their time in school, and oftentimes their out-of-school time is also spent on school-related activities or homework. And so I think schools do play a role in the unhealthy culture that we've created, and I think it's a really important first step to engage all stakeholders in a community, to bring parents together, educators together, health professionals, and importantly, the students, and to listen to the relief that the students are feeling that they need.
So great. I want to reintroduce the program at this point. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing school-based interventions to help prevent teen suicide. We were listening there to three of our guests, Dr. Shashank Joshi of Stanford University, Dr. Denise Herman, who's the principal at Gunn High School in Palo Alto, and just there, Vicki Abeles, education reformer, director, and producer of Race to Nowhere and Beyond Measure, two documentaries about the academic pressures on our youth. It's time to open our phone lines to you, our listeners, if you want to call in with a question or comment. What do you think should be done in the schools to help reduce teen stress, anxiety, depression, and to prevent suicide? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. We have some other ways for you to reach us as well. You could text or email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment at the KALW website. So I actually want to bring the student voice into the conversation at this point. So Shauna Chen, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, of course. I'm glad to be here.
You're a senior at Gunn High School, editor-in-chief of the school newspaper, and creator of the Changing the Narrative series that some of our guests have alluded to already. I wanted to hear from you. As you listened, for lack of a better term, to these adults around the table talking about the experience of that could be shared by you and your classmates and other students across the country, what was going through your mind?
I think a lot of what Dr. Joshi and Dr. Herman and Ms. Abeles said is very true. I think certainly in my school and in my community, there is a level of stress and perfection that I think a lot of our students feel that they need to work for. And I think that a lot of times when you feel like everybody around you is doing so well and is so extraordinary, you feel like you can't keep up. And because you feel like they're so much higher than you, you feel like if you talk about your own weaknesses or your own struggles, you may feel invalidated or unheard. And I think that's why a lot of students, maybe not all, I can't speak for all, but a lot of students I know don't always reach out because of that. There certainly does exist a stigma in our community. And in the past, I do think in the past it was worse. I think now conversation is starting to open up and people are really starting to talk about the idea of kind of emotional vulnerability, being vulnerable with each other about things that are hard to talk about, but being honest and being truthful about them.
What kind of conversations have you been having with your peers, with fellow students, as the years unfold and you see changes that are being implemented from the administration of your school?
I think that I think definitely students are feeling less like they have to hide. I definitely think that my peers and I are talking a lot more about things such as depression and talking about things such as anxiety and helping each other when there are times when, you know, a friend maybe has a panic attack or is really stressed out about something. There is more of a bond and an accessibility to each other. And I think that's something that's come with just talking more about it and definitely hearing more about it from everybody else. When the community is focused on mental health and student well-being, and it's at the forefront of their minds, that's when students are also able to open up about that as well.
Are you noticing any particular groups of students that perhaps are opposed to these kinds of changes or feel like this is not necessary and it's, you know, it's other kids that need this kind of adjustment in the school environment? How widespread do you feel the acceptance of these kinds of changes are amongst your peers?
I don't think I can't name any off the top of my head that I know of students who are against the changes or against talking about mental health. I think everybody in our community, GUN is often portrayed by outside media as kind of this alien group that, is in an affluent place, is kind of in the center of success, and people who don't talk to each other or connect with each other very well. But from my experience, my community, my friends, my peers, they all care about each other very, very much. And we're all, like, we have a class group on Facebook, and people are always posting, kind of encouraging messages, trying to brighten each other's days, and just being there for each other. I think there are always the few people or minority who disagree with some of the changes, but I think that the majority of students feel that change is necessary, and that it's a step forward in talking about these things and having that honest dialogue.
So what inspired you to create the Changing the Narrative series? And tell us a little bit more about it.
Right. So in September, Ms. Blackburn and I were invited to a media workshop held by the Palo Alto Medical Foundation. And the speaker there was Dr. Madeline Gold, who is a professor at Columbia University. And she talked about her research into teen suicide and suicide clusters. And one of the things she said that really stuck with me was how the idea of positive messaging and stories of hope and recovery did, in some cases, minimize the likelihood of a cluster happening. And so I was talking to Blackburn and thinking, what can we do to help to maybe use the student newspaper and make that step forward in changing the narrative in the community? And so that's kind of how the idea was born of a series. We talked to a lot of our staff members, a lot of people, students who had been friends with the students who died last year, and a lot of them believed that it was also the right step and a good idea in terms of opening up conversation. And so we worked very closely with our on-campus mental health wellness coordinator, and always made sure that the content would not be a trigger for anybody else. And our first narrative was published, I think, in October or November, and it was from one of our staff members on the Oracle who had struggled with depression. And she talked very candidly about how she had felt up to the turning point. And then she, again, very honestly talked about her recovery process and how, even though it's not sunshine and rainbows every day, it's a step forward, and it's something that makes her feel more alive. And I think that resonated with a lot of students online. That first post garnered, like, we track our website statistics, and that post went to very many places. It went very far on social media, in all these different newsletters, and even media from Palo Alto Weekly. And people were reposting the story and saying things like, this is everything I've always wanted to say, or thank you for being so honest. And a lot of students we found ended up messaging that staff member and telling her things like, I'm in a similar situation, how can I get to where you are, and how can I help myself? And we found that kind of using that pathway to open up that conversation and redirect students to more trusted adults was something that was beneficial and positive for the community. So since then, we've published a number of other stories. It's not necessarily just about mental health. I think the idea is to talk about challenges and obstacles in everyday life and to normalize talking about them, because so often and you hear about the success stories of people who went so far and did all these great things, but you never really hear about the 100 or 1,000 or 5,000 times that they failed before they get there, right, where they faced obstacles before they got there. And I think that's kind of the point of our mission, to to talk about these struggles and to help students feel that it's okay to face a challenge because there is always hope.
Well, thanks very much, Shauna. We'll get back to you more in a little bit. That was Shauna Chen. She's a senior at Gunn High School and editor-in-chief of the student newspaper. And she was describing there the Changing the Narrative series that she launched at the school last year to help normalize the stress that students are enduring. So I want to, again, put out our phone number if you want to join us tonight on City Visions here on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. We're talking about school-based interventions to help prevent teen suicide. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also text and email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at our website, the KLW website. Let's go to Karen from Berkeley. Karen, welcome to the program.
Oh, good evening. I'm so glad you're talking about this. I grew up back east. I had a public school education. First grade, middle school, high school, all public. I graduated. I have a bachelor and master's degree. And we used to have recess and art class and music and field trips and get out of the classroom. And now they've in order to force the kids to just do this, you know, memorizing everything, whatever the program is, No Child Left Behind or any of that kind of garbage, the kids are just they're just suffering. They sit with their ears plugged up with earphones. They're on Facebook. They're on the cell phone when not in the class. And then when they're in the class, all they want to do is get them in front of a screen. So they're isolated, and we all know how exclusive kids can get, especially in junior high and high school. And so, you know, the postings and the social media, that can just broadcast exclusivity and create more alienation. So these kids are sitting there with their ears plugged up, staring at a screen, with radio frequency buzzing on them, and they're not even getting a chance to go out swimming. They've cut all these kinds of programs across the country. And now, oh, the schools are not doing good. We got to have charter schools. Charter schools, charter schools. No, you don't. All you have to do is go back to old-fashioned public school education. You get good teachers with decent pay, and you go back to civilized time teaching and teaching kids and treating kids like they're human beings and not robots. That's my comment. I am a parent, and that's my comment to the listening audience and to your guests tonight.
Thanks so much, Karen, for your call. So, Shashank, you, I know you wanted to jump in there a couple of times.
Well, it's actually timely because the New York Times did a piece a few years back about recess as the fourth R, in particular for elementary school. And, you know, the teachers that get it know that's the last thing you want to do is take away recess, especially if you're trying to include some sort of, you know, disciplinary action. That's going to be a lose-lose. The kid's going to be inside driving the teacher crazy, you know. You've got to get the kids outside, absolutely. It's one of the reasons why when you hear researchers talk about the importance of regular physical activity. And that's, you know, from K-12 and beyond. A thing I wanted to talk about beforehand that Shauna actually highlighted nicely was this idea of students sharing their personal stories of strength and recovery. And if you go to the Oracle website, if you just search for Changing the Narrative Oracle or Gunn High School, G-U-N-N, you'll get their page. And the stories that they share there highlight the idea that we've got to be really careful before we draw a direct link between stress and taking one's life. There are a lot of things that happen before, even in stressful environments. Humans are made for self-preservation. But when you add up all of the different factors, notably history of mental illness in the person or mental health issues, and then you combine it with interpersonal stressors that feel out of the teen's control and the developing adolescent brain. And if that's combined with a easy means to take one's life, whether that's at a bridge site like the Golden Gate Bridge or other places around the country, you know, iconic sites that then become symbols of what happens when someone gets desperate, if they're not covered properly by some media outlets have really done a nice job of this. The AFSP, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, has developed, in conjunction with the Annenberg Foundation and other national media outlets, guidelines for reporting on these events that always include, like you did nicely, they're talking about always having resources available whenever you talk about this subject. And what Shauna was talking about is, it's important not only to talk about stress and to talk about that this happens in the guise of an everyday life, but it's also important to talk about stories of recovery and stories of help and how I got through this. And if you read these stories, they're very well done. And you know, reflecting back on Dr. Gould's research around not only messaging but positive messaging and how it's done, and how students on the ground at Gunn and Pali and Castellea and St. Ignatius and Sacred Heart Prep and several other schools around the area are saying, you know, we have to take a path that promotes both suicide prevention and wellness, mm-hmm. and that you need both of those in order to really develop an atmosphere where people can talk about not only you know, what kinds of stressors are going through, but also what they've done to get through these.
Vicky, I wanted to bring you in at this point because not that the prevention of teen suicide isn't good enough reason to be making these changes, but if you also could take us to the level of understanding of how this kind of educational system is actually impacting our society at large. Tell us more about what you've learned in terms of how the educational system is affecting people's preparedness as they're going into college, joining the workforce.
Right. So long-term, what we're seeing is college professors, about 14% of college professors and about 29% of industry employers believe that today's students are underprepared. They're not prepared with the kind of thinking skills they need. They're not prepared to be flexible. They're not prepared to think deeply and solve problems. And I think when we think about our kids' experience, K through 12 as well as at the university level, we're not giving our students much time to practice those skills during the school day. Our system is so oriented around what many of us experienced in school with a teacher up front lecturing and this idea of delivering curriculum and then the students taking notes, going home, preparing for the next day and regurgitating. And I think we now know so much more about the way that we learn and about how to optimize student performance both in childhood as well as beyond, that I think that we need to start transforming our schools and looking at the experience of students and how they learn and prioritize new things, prioritize deep, meaningful learning, project-based learning, experiential learning, learning experiences that offer the opportunity to go back to the health issues for students to form good relationships with one another, to have opportunity to connect with their teachers. I think then we're going to start to see students who are much better, much healthier in the present and much better prepared for their futures, for a future that is uncertain.
And Denise Herman, I wonder, as you highlighted some of the changes that you're making in your school, how are you – what kinds of responses have you been getting from, let's say, parents or others who feel like, wait, we're going to make it easy on the kids. Isn't that going to jeopardize their future? Tell us about how you understand how these pieces fit together, how pressure can actually be, you know, counterproductive at a certain point, to a certain extent, and that, in fact, easing up can actually be better.
Well, I think parents listen to what their students have to say, and loud and clear, students are saying that we want to do challenging work. We just want to do work that's meaningful to us, that's going to be connected to what we know now and what we know our futures are going to be demanding of us. And so I think the parents want that too. I think that the parents that have come to some of our focus group meetings and some of the things that we've been doing to educate parents about our new schedule or about some of our other initiatives, they're very clear that they want that optimum balance of academic rigor balanced with well-being. And I think that's really what our staff and students and parents are trying to say, what can that look like in a public school? And it does mean that some things need to change. We looked at some of our infrastructure things with time and the schedule. We're also looking at things, like Vicky said, with our curriculum. Another important driver that we're a part of is the college admissions race. And I'm hopeful by the report released last week from Harvard University that calls into questions many of the criteria and practices and protocols that have been used by many of the highly selective schools that sort of narrow the focus of students.
Including Harvard?
They were very self-deprecating in the article talking about, you know, us counting the number of APs that students have or us making it be the number of community service hours that you do rather than what are you benefiting from it.
I think you referred this in your article, race for credentials. Is that a term? I saw this term somewhere, race for credentials.
I think that sometimes at the high school level, you can feel like we can sometimes work very hard to make adjustments to make our school setting, you know, nurturing and balanced. But some parents or other people say, but I want them prepared for college. And it was very refreshing to hear that colleges were saying the students that we're receiving have such a narrow focus that when they reach our doorsteps, they're not as creative and they're not as open-minded and they're not as flexible as we know they could be. And we might be contributing that by how we select our student body.
And other examples, Vicki, and we have a couple of callers I want you to hold because I'm going to get to you. But I really just want to make sure I follow up on this point. Vicki, are there examples of places that have changed their paradigm and have seen success?
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
And so those stories, I want to say we feature those stories in our new film, Beyond Measure, which is about four public schools that are collaborating with schools that have been innovating for the last decade. These are positive stories of schools that are transforming the way that students learn, the way teachers teach, and the way that we assess that learning. Importantly, in our book, which shares a title with a film, inspirational stories from across the country of students, parents, and educators working together to address issues like homework, too much testing, too much college resume building, and then to look forward to the schools that we need for the future, schools that are prioritizing well-being and prioritizing learning. I mean, I think we have to ask, how do we move from schooling to learning? And so I think there are a number of schools that are transforming that experience. Just to go back to what Denise said about the report that came out last week, and that report was from Harvard School of Education. I think that's really hopeful. I'm interested in seeing the action that accompanies that. But in the meantime, I've always said that I don't think that we need to wait for colleges to change their admissions practices or for policies to change. I really believe that grassroots change is going to shift this paradigm, and that means school communities coming together. We have dozens of schools across the country that have eliminated AP courses, and instead the teachers are driving the curriculum and the assessment. IndependentCurriculumGroup.org is a great resource for people who are interested. That organization has grown from about a dozen schools to, the last time I looked, nearly 100 schools. Lots of organizations across the country working to create change.
Again, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and here with Dr. Shashank Joshi, who's at Stanford and the C.O. Paco Children's Hospital, and Denise Herman, who's also a doctor, and principal at Gunn High School in Palo Alto, Vicki Abeles, education reformer, documentarian, writer, on this issue of stress in our teens. Shauna Chen, senior at Gunn High School and editor-in-chief of The Oracle, and Christy Blackburn, we'll get to you, I promise. She's an advisor at Gunn. We invite you to listen, your listeners, to join in our conversation, 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org and post a comment at our website. So let's go to those callers. Let's go to Sean from San Francisco. Welcome to the program. Sean, are you there? Have we lost Sean? We may have lost Sean. Okay, let's go to Paul from Sean, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there.
Oh, there you are. Okay. Hi, welcome to the program.
Anyways, thank you. I have two boys that live in Japan, and they're 14 and 11 years old, and I live in Japan 6 months of the year to be with them. And they have a regular 5-day-a-week school schedule, which starts from 7 and ends pretty much at 5, and then they finish off with basketball or whatever. And then 3 days a week they have Juku, which is just an after-school program for just more schooling. 6 days a week with some sort of activity. So the pressures to achieve are pretty high there, and I would say almost equal to what I see from when they were going to school here. The thing that I see that is different between the Japanese society and our society is the lack of hostility in their society outside of the schools. When you turn on the news or the murder rate or the violence or the crime, the drugs, everything just kind of goes on and on, and particularly with the presidential races and all the, I mean, just the hatred that comes out of there. How much of that affects the kids? Because it seems to me, I think that's got to be a lot of pressure dealing just what you hear on the normal news on top of a regular school schedule. And that's my question.
Okay, I'll let you take your answer off of the air. Thanks for your call.
You.
Go ahead, Shashank.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I think it's true. You know, the media basically has unfettered access to our youth unless we do something about it. You know, when it comes to their phones and social media, as parents, we have much less control than what they see on TV. So I actually think that, you know, there's been some research looking at a concept called sedimented stress, which is, you know, you take the everyday stressors of being a teenager, and then you put on top of that some things that teens feel like are completely out of their control. So some of the things the caller mentioned that are happening in society, they get portrayed in a certain sensationalized way often in the media, or certain things going around them in their neighborhoods, or you know, things that may be going on at home around interpersonal stress or poverty, other things that are out of their control, things they hear on the media. That can make the everyday stress much harder to take. And if you combine that with a history of mental health issues or mental illness, then that can make those coping strategies that you normally reach for, that you may have learned about in talk therapy, a little harder to access because you now may get overwhelmed by some of the things that are happening in your environment. So I do think that, you know, empowering parents to control as much as possible some of the media diet, especially if you have a vulnerable young person who may be struggling with a mental health condition, or someone who is pretty involved in what they're doing and maybe there's a higher than usual level of stress. I think that's important for parents to be able to, as much as possible, take even more control of the media diet.
Vicky, my understanding is that a lot of our educational reform in this country really came from the recognition that our students were underperforming compared to students in other countries. Has your research or travels taken you outside of the U.S. To be able to tell us kind of how we compare?
No, we've considered that. I'm familiar with what's happening in a number of countries. One of the things that surprised me in the beginning is Race to Nowhere is really a story of American students in American schools, and yet that film has been well received in about 50 countries around the globe that are struggling with these very same issues. Just last week, I was on Skype conversation with a screening taking place in London. So these issues are global. I do think there are some countries that seem to be getting it more right than we are. Finland is often the example that is highlighted as a school system that is much more developmentally appropriate, aligned with kids' developmental needs, far less testing, far less homework, and much better results in terms of turning out young people who are ready to contribute in positive ways.
415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Again, 415-841-4134. Let's go to Paul from Oakland.
Hi, this is Paul, and I wanted to offer a recommendation of a book I just read called The Teenage Brain. And one of the things that's interesting there is they talk about, for teenagers, physiologically, it doesn't even make sense to start putting them under academic grind before 9 or 10.
Are you there?
Pragmatic probability of being able to slide, at least say for late middle school through high school, slide the starting time back for students so that they actually have a shot at it and can get the rest they need. And I'll take my answer offline. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much. Yes, Vicky, you were going to say something
else. I mean, there's good research about the importance of starting school later. I know a number of schools across the country are doing this. An entire school district in Seattle, Washington, just implemented later start times. That's certainly a place for schools to start.
Let's go next to Jackie from San Francisco. Jackie.
Yeah, I'm wondering what the data shows in terms of the actual causes that lead to teenage suicide. And I know it's a basic question, but it almost seems like we've gotten off track a bit here over the hour.
So, okay, thanks for your question there, Jackie.
Yeah, and I think he may be referring to the idea that we tried to highlight before, being very, very careful before one draws and focuses too much on stress equals suicidal thinking. The data are very clear. Over the course of a lifetime, somewhere between 65 to 90% of people who take their life by suicide have had a diagnosable mental health condition for at least a year. They often will have told someone about their contemplating suicide as well. And so that often happens, again, in people with a history of mental illness and mental health struggles. And that is the most important stressor. That's the most important risk factor, in addition to having someone who with whom you've had contact, like a friend of yours who may have taken their life by suicide. That increases your risk even if you've never had an attempt yourself. But I do think that it's important that we talk not only about nature, which is, you know, the biological risk factors and the family risk factors and the genetics, but also nurture and the kind of environment that you're being raised in. Because we do know that with any outcome, with really any mental health condition we talk about, it's both nature and nurture. We don't have as much control over the nature. We have a lot more control over the kind of nurture we provide in terms of environment, in terms of parenting. A lot of our immigrant families we work with who are looking for ways to raise bicultural kids, and it's not easy to do. Every family has their own culture and their own house. You can't draw these broad strokes and say, you know, these people are like that, those people are like that. I do think there are important cultural parameters to keep in mind when you're working with certain populations, but I also think that it's important to distinguish between everyday stress that teens can often bounce back from and do, and the kind of stress that turns to desperation when in the context of a mental health condition such as depression or anxiety.
So I'm wondering about how – I'm just thinking, is there a parent out there that would say, well, you know, there isn't any history of mental illness in my family and my child seems totally fine. Why does anything need to change when this is specifically – the risk is amplified or only there if a child has a mental health issue? How would you respond to that?
Well, I'd say two things. One is – yes, the mental health history, if it is filled with risk factors like history of a mood disorder in a family or in that person, that absolutely elevates the risk. But we also know that if a teen is struggling, normally teens are able to get through their adolescence and they're engaged and they can, you know, if they get stressed, they bounce back. They find ways to maintain positivity or they find ways to be resilient. That's the normal pathway. But if teens are no longer doing the kinds of things they enjoy because they're so stressed about school or they're so busy with extracurriculars that they're no longer really having time for themselves that are not scheduled, and this is important, that they start to show signs that they might be more sad than usual, that they might be losing interest in things, and that their sleep is suffering, and they're not getting the 8.5 to 9.5 hours that Vicki referenced before that's recommended by the Academy of Pediatrics and the National Sleep Foundation, then it's time to pay attention, because you want to try and address those things early to make sure that the balance spreadsheet's really being attended to, if you will.
So I have been remiss about not bringing Christy Blackburn into the conversation until the end of the program here. But Christy, thanks for being patient there on the other line there. Tell us about your experience as an advisor to the student newspaper and the students over at Gunn High School. What kinds of transformation have you seen, and what kinds of initiatives have you been a part of that might be important to highlight here?
So I think part of that, of what's important, is the culture of caring that we're trying to create at Gunn High School and kind of reinforce year after year. I've been part of Not in Our Schools Week for the past 10 to 12 years as well, and that's a week that is it's a year-long program, but it's specifically a week devoted to empathy building and kind of talking about how we are as a school and embracing our differences. Also, Sources of Strength is a great program as well, and thinking about the idea Shoshank had about how people kind of can bounce back. This gives kids language of how to find the sources of strength in their life. And what I appreciate about it the most is there are like 8 different strengths you can pull on. And so we have started a campaign this year as teachers called the I Am Stronger campaign. And what we've done is we've put up posters of ourselves with a little blurb about where we gather our source of strength from. and kind of highlight the wheel that it comes from. So, for example, mine was family support, and my husband, who's also a teacher, is very supportive of me in all my activities. He always reminds me, hey, let's take a break, let's go to the boardwalk, let's do something fun. And so that was my poster, was kind of highlighting his role in helping me maintain my balance. As the advisor, I think that the initiative we've done with Change Narrative is amazing. We've gotten a lot of feedback from both staff and students that it is opening conversations a lot more, and I think the series we're planning to continue throughout the school year, so I'm hoping that we'll raise more awareness and have more conversations that students know that there are trusted adults on campus they can talk to, and my journalism staff, I think, knows that about me, which is helpful because we've had a lot of really good, serious conversations about how to cover student stress and student suicide responsibly, and that, I think, is the most important thing, too.
And Shauna, back to you for a moment. What other changes would you like to see happen at Gunn High School? You're graduating this year, but what would you like to see happen after you leave?
Well, along with what Lachlan said, actually, I think a lot of amazing initiatives put forth by students have been creating waves, not to mention sources of strength, but beyond just sources of strength, there's a student wellness committee that was created by students to talk about mental health, stress. They connected with a recent alumni to come back and talk to current students about life after Gunn. There's a club on campus called Reach Out Care Know that's really been proactive in sending everybody messages of kind of hope and positive and getting through the day. And I think, honestly, I think our community has come a long, long way since 2009 when the first cluster was occurred. I think not a lot of people necessarily see that from the outside. We've had a lot of outside media, as I mentioned earlier, come in and kind of look for a specific cause, you know, looking at, oh, is it parents, or is it the school, or is it Silicon Valley, is it overloading APs and all that. And I think, you know, we're never going to know all the reasons. It's like Dr. Joshi said, it's very, very complex. And this year, the conversations I've had with my fellow peers has really just emphasized that for me, that it's so much bigger than just one thing or two things or even three things. And I think that we are on the right track. I think we're doing a lot of things to create that change, to have those conversations, and I have to say I am very proud to be a Gunn Titan and to be part of that moving forward, and I can only hope that students after me will care just as much as they do now, and as well teachers and principals to be doing that and to be continuing that in the future.
Thank you. So for your in-studio guests, you're each going to get 30 seconds. So Denise Herman, what's on tap for other changes that are coming in the next school year?
Well, I just first want to compliment Shauna for being such an exemplary Gunn student, and I too am proud to be a Titan as a principal. In terms of next steps, really reinforcing what we know the students are saying they need. I think another important issue that we've been trying to make sure we're fostering is student voice. And Shauna and her staff and other students have been very vocal in letting us know what they think they need, that they want to be involved in decision-making for the school. They want choice in how they learn, and I think all of those things are going to help us in the future.
Dr. Joshi, you promised me some resources that we're going to post
yes.
on our website.
Yes, so I'm going to highlight a few of them. There's one of them that I really like called authentichappiness.sas.upenn, that's University of Pennsylvania, so UPENN.edu. That's a positive psychology website. I've had the pleasure of teaching a course for Stanford undergrads on wellness and positive psychology that really looks at what kinds of things maintain a happy, healthy lifestyle. There's a wonderful group called Let's Bring Change to Mind, which is operating on several school campuses, including Palo Alto High School and Castalea, looking at stigma reduction. It's a national organization that is now based in high schools. And then finally, in addition to sources of strength, there's a program called Youth Aware of Mental Health, which has been very instrumental in getting basically the narrative to change, I guess, if you would say, as a universal program like Shauna and Christy talked about.
And Vicki Abeles, what's the website people can go to learn more about your work?
BeyondMeasureFilm.com and RaceToNowhere.com.
Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening, Dr. Shashank Joshi, Dr. Denise Herman, Vicki Abeles, Christy Blackburn, and Shauna Chen. For a link to this and other City Visions episodes, or to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was the patient Debbie Kennedy. He's going to kill me for going so late. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klan and Susie Britton. And join me next Monday as we look to the impact of Super Bowl 50 on the Bay Area. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a good week.